I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. It's spring. From community gardens to guerrilla gardens to backyard and rooftop gardens, people are finding creative ways to grow plants for food, medicine, and beauty. California is gifted with many microclimates and soil types suited to growing all kinds of wonderful plants. And especially in the valleys and coastal areas, with our relatively warm weather year-round, there's no season when we can't have something thriving in the garden, whether it's cool weather kale or summer sunflowers. In California, we also have a growing movement for food justice. In urban areas where residents have few or no stores or markets offering fresh produce, the skills, resources, and space to garden for food can be invaluable. So whether you garden for your supper or your senses, we want to hear your thoughts on what gardening means to you. How were you introduced to it? What keeps you doing it? If you have a garden, where is it? What are you planting this spring, and what tips would you offer other local gardeners? If you don't have a garden, do you find other ways to connect with plants or local food production? How does gardening change your feeling of connection to the natural world or to your community? Can local gardens help people lead healthier lives? With us talking about that today is Pam Pierce. She is a master gardener and the author of Golden Gate Gardening, The Complete Guide to Year-Round Food Gardening in the San Francisco Bay Area and Coastal California. She's also the author of Wildly Successful Plants, Northern California. And in the early 1980s, Pam participated in the founding of the San Francisco League of Urban Gardeners, or SLUG. She writes a garden Q&A column for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you.
And Daniel Miller is also joining us. He's executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project. It's a nonprofit in Southwest Berkeley designed to create healthy, sustainable communities by promoting a strong local food system and encouraging productive use of urban soil. The programs at Spiral Gardens include a plant nursery, produce stand, community farm, community education, and a community harvest project. Hi.
Hi. Thanks. I'm honored to be here.
We are so glad to have you both, and it's so fun to get to talk about gardening today. So let's kind of start with a lightning round. I'll give out our number in just a moment, but what is important to each of you about gardening? What's the significance of gardening? Pam, why don't we start with you?
Okay. My father was a farmer. I'm a farmer's daughter, but of course I lived in the city. He grew up on a farm, and it's sort of my culture to plant and grow things. It was taught to me as a child. I love watching plants grow. It's watching another form of life unfold. I love to eat. That helps. It's a kind of a game. It's a slow sport from month to month and from year to year, and seeing how much I can get out of a garden in terms of beauty and food. And finally, I love to help others learn to do the same thing.
Uh-huh. That's great. How about you, Daniel?
Well, I've been a city boy all my life. I've been in the Bay Area since I was born, and gardening keeps me sane primarily here.
There's a good reason.
But I love it because I think it's a great way to tap into the source. It's a wellspring of resources for everybody if they just learn how to treat their dirt like soil. And every kind of pressing issue that needs to be addressed can be wrapped into gardening, whether it's ecology, sustainability, economy, climate, jobs, justice, peace, and the whole litany of issues can all be addressed in gardening.
Oh, okay. And how did you come to gardening?
I came to it in college. I was trying to find some way to figure out how to help people live on the planet. And I was calling it social ecology at the time, and I was trying to figure out how that could work. Eventually, I took a permaculture workshop back in 1990, and that was just an avenue to me into the magic of how many things can be done and how gracefully gardening can be just ultimately productive. And that was the jumping off point for me. And I've been in the school of fake it till you make it ever since.
Nice. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. And we want to invite you to join us on our gardening show. What is the significance of gardening in your life, and how were you introduced to it? What keeps you doing it? If you have a garden, where is it? And what are you planting this spring? You can call us at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Do you have tips for other local gardeners? And if you don't have a garden, do you find other ways to connect with plants or local food production? How does gardening change your feeling of connection to the natural world or to your community? And do you think gardens can help people live healthier lives? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Talk. That toll-free number again is 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And our new website, you can also post comments. That's yourcallradio.org. So let me ask each of you, Daniel and Pam, what's in your garden right now at home? Go ahead, Pam.
Well, I have two gardens. I have my backyard and I have a small community garden. And the community garden has collards and Swiss chard that grew way too big, so I'm having to give it away.
Yes, and chard will do that.
Yeah, only six plants, but they're, 2 feet tall. And some Portuguese kale, which is very similar to collards. And I have some fava beans that I'm eating roasted baby pods. And I also have just put in cucumbers and tromboncino squash and a pole Romano bean.
You're making me hungry. How about you, Daniel? What's in your garden right now?
Well, right now is a real transition time. And if I can impart anything on this show, it's a sense of the seasons in the Bay Area. We're coming out of our cool season when it's been mostly greens and alliums, that's the onion family, and peas and root crops. And so I've been up to my neck in greens all winter long. And just at this point, starting to venture putting in squash and a tomato or two, but really trying to hold back because contrary to popular opinion, especially if you walk into a big box store and look at their nursery selection, the soil is not up to 60 degrees yet around here, and it takes at least till May. And the late rains we had are probably going to delay that a little bit. But you got to hold your horses just a minute before
you can
put in all those hot weather stuff that you really love.
Okay, well, I appreciate that because I'm literally going to be doing some gardening this weekend. We just got everything all ready to plant. So you were going to say
that's
something.
That's true. Okay? My tomatoes are still on my windowsill. They're not ready.
So I've never been able to grow tomatoes. I live in Oakland, kind of up by the Joaquin Miller Park, and we cannot successfully grow tomatoes.
What goes wrong?
They don't mature. Sometimes the gophers take them.
Right.
So there is that.
There is that, right?
But no, they don't become ripe.
Do they set fruit? It stays green?
Yep.
Got to get a really early variety.
Early variety, okay.
One that's 70 days or less from transplant to harvest. Put it in the sunniest spot you've got.
Yeah. Try it. I've tried.
You should
be able to ripen tomatoes. All right. Yeah, go ahead, Daniel.
They're not, even though they're the first thing that comes to mind for people gardening, they're not the optimum crop around here because we're so influenced by the bay, the temperatures. Unless you're over the ridge over in the Contra Costa or further down south, San Jose, it's just not quite hot enough, and you can make it work, and you have to become a real expert, like Pam said, in early varieties and on the whole host of tomato diseases and resistant varieties. But it's also good to venture out and find a lot of other favorite crops.
Okay, we'll do. And so tell me, what are some of the common reasons people are afraid to plant a garden, and what can you tell people to entice them to it?
People are afraid they have something in their soil that will make it poisoned.
Mm.
And so
you can get it tested,
yeah,
right?
You just get it tested, and it's worth the money that it costs to do it. The California Co-op Extension System does not do it for free as they do in many states, but you should go to a local nursery or harmonyfarm.com in Sebastopol and find a place that will
test your soil.
We'll send it to a lab for you and find out, because it's just ridiculous to wait for years and not, or they think they don't have soil.
Or are there other
fears
that I just can't grow anything?
Probably that too, but I'm saying that this is a barrier that a lot of people shouldn't let be a barrier. They should just get it tested for once and for all.
Yeah, the fear of not knowing is the second one I want to address. The first is soil testing. I like the University of Massachusetts Soil Research Lab. For about $10, they'll test for all the nutrients and heavy metals.
Mm-hmm,
and if you add a few bucks more, you can get further testing on it. And it's fear of, I don't know how to garden. I have a so-called black thumb. And I say, well, black is the color of good soil. So you're actually on a good start. And what else can you do that you've never done before? You know, you can't do anything until you start trying. And it's from your mistakes that you learn. Just like on your car, the things that break are the things you eventually know how to fix.
That's great. That's Daniel Miller. He's executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project. That's a nonprofit in Southwest Berkeley. We're also joined by Pam Pierce, who is a master gardener and the author of Golden Gate Gardening, the complete guide to year-round food gardening in the San Francisco Bay Area and coastal California. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. And I'm going to invite we've got a lot of people online that we want to get to. The number to join our gardening discussion is 866-798-2. Talk. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. We want to know what you're planting in your garden right now, and how does gardening connect you to local communities and food security? And our producer here wanted me to ask you about how does gardening relate to access to fresh food, especially in communities where there may not be that access, Daniel?
Well, there's a term called food deserts that people use a lot, and community food security, and it has to do with the whole pattern that there's a linear relationship between low-income neighborhoods and access to fresh produce. If a mapping of them will show that there's an overabundance of liquor stores, but there's been a flight, a redlining of supermarkets from those neighborhoods, and that corresponds to a higher incidence of chronic disease in those neighborhoods. In Southwest Berkeley, where we work, the folks of color, low-income people in that neighborhood, not necessarily the same, but often there's a cross between the two, have died 10 years earlier than the average in Berkeley. If you're a black man, you're probably going to die of heart disease. There's stroke, diabetes, a whole list of things that are proven preventable by diet and exercise. So access to food can save lives. And if you can't afford nutritious food or you don't have access to it, there's always a little soil around you. In low-income neighborhoods also tend to have the most vacant lots. So it's a resource that's there that people can tap into.
Increasingly people are doing that, starting community gardens, starting urban farms in West Oakland. I know that that's happening a lot. So this is a growing movement.
Exactly. And it's called an assets-based approach, where you look at the resources that are in neighborhoods rather than talking about what they don't have.
Uh-huh, an assets-based approach. Yeah. I like that. Now, I've heard, though, that when community gardens are flourishing, that can actually lead to so-called gentrification.
That's a big issue, and that's the double edge to gardening, is that the community garden, hopefully it's going to bring in direct resources for people in low-income neighborhoods, but they can also raise the property values of the neighborhoods, and they make neighborhoods safer just by bringing communities together.
Why do they make neighborhoods safer?
Because it brings people out. It brings people together. It brings, you know, the idea of a neighborhood watch, community policing, you know, where people are out, they know each other, they have their eye on the street, you know, they're engaged in positive activity. All of that comes together to take neighborhoods to a higher level. But the other side of it is it also, you know, it can increase property values. It can bring, higher income people into the neighborhood. And so it's really important that people talk about this, that this issue is on the table, and that community gardens are aware of how that impacts it and take steps to counteract that.
Well, and that's Daniel Miller. He's executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project. We're also joined by Pam Pierce, who's a master gardener and the author of Golden Gate Gardening. And let's go to your calls. Let's hear first. Oh, yeah, we'll get to your calls in just a sec. Pam,
go ahead. I did want to say something about that, is that please. I certainly support community gardens as I've done over the years. And I think that everything Daniel said is true. But I think we really downplay the role of culture in what people eat, and that it can be more important than the accessibility of food even. That it's a food culture in our society, which is mediated by what's available from corporations that would like us to buy what is cheap and easy and fast for them to provide for us, and that people eat it, and that when you introduce gardens into low-income areas, you find out that a lot of people actually, that's part of their culture too, and they're not being able to pass the fact that you can grow your own food onto their children because they don't have that. So it's not that that's not part of their culture. It is part of the culture, but that it's not being passed on so that the children are not learning that. And that I would downplay the accessibility of food and in grocery stores and upplay the fact that the culture needs to be, that the culture shift can happen.
Well, and isn't that changing gardens, a lot here in California
community
in particular?
Community gardens can help that along.
And isn't that something that we've really seen a change in the last, say, 10 years, 20 years here in California? An increase in these kinds of community gardens and growing food in urban areas,
Absolutely. And it is fighting against the tide of processed food. And, you know, cheap food is always the least healthy food. And I absolutely agree with what Pam said as well, mm-hmm. that the culture is a big part of it. So it's planting the seeds of a new culture. And as we go along, I think one of the big changes in the last couple decades is that culture of very nutritious food, not just dealing with hunger, but nutrition, and culturally appropriate foods, and solving that generational gap of culture is becoming more diverse, and a lot more people are becoming aware of it. With the information technology available, I think that is really disseminating at this point.
That is Daniel Miller, and we're also joined by Pam Pierce. I'm Holly Kernan. This is Your Call. And let's go to our callers. Let's hear from Lupe in Hollister. Welcome to Your Call, Lupe.
Hi, thank you for receiving my call.
Absolutely.
I just say thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Organizations like you have inspired my family and I. We recently funded a community farm in Hollister because we noticed that there was a lot of promotion for healthy eating and physical activity, but those two things seem to be a luxury for people in our community, especially people of low income, because there's one, they cannot afford organic products, and it's really expensive to buy some of the healthy foods, and the food bank provides help, but they sometimes, what you mentioned in it, they don't have culturally appropriate foods, and they get these meals that sometimes they don't know how to cook or how to eat it. So my family and I, we started a small project, just us, and now we have a group of volunteers, and we grow about 2 acres of food just with the help of volunteers in collaboration of the food bank, and we open a space for people to relax on the weekends, especially people who have little kids and they don't really have a safe space to go and socialize with other people and talk about healthy eating and share information and ideas about how to stay healthy. So we are doing that right now, and it's really exciting to see the interest of the community, and also how just providing a small space opens up an entire window of opportunities. We have a teacher, for instance, who is a volunteer, and he began this project doing aquaponics to teach little
aquaponics,
kids.
Aquaponics, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing that, and we're really excited. Last year, we produced about 7,000 pounds of fruit, including tomatoes.
Right on.
Wow. Lupe, what's your garden called? What's your farm called?
Comstock Community Farm.
Comstock Community Farm?
Yes.
And what did you say? You said you're also producing for the food bank. Did I hear you right?
Yes. Well, every single pound of food that we produced was donated to the food bank and also to the volunteers that participated in our project.
Fantastic.
Can you tell us what kind of support you get from other institutions? Does the
food
bank?
We don't have any financial support.
Very good.
So we rely on donations.
Then you're doing great. I just was curious because sometimes there is, then other people can learn from that, you know, if there is help from somebody.
Well, it's really inspiring. It sounds like you just went out and did it and made it happen. Is that about right?
We did it and we learned. We make mistakes, but we learn along the way, and people give us ideas, and they're helping us right now. They're telling us, why don't you try to get some funding to maintain it, to keep it sustainable, because it's really exciting. But then after the second year, this is going to be the third year that we do this project. Mm-hmm. And we have all these interests of the community, so we're trying to look out for help. And our goal will be to eventually be a resource for people to help them start their own community gardens and start their own projects at home,
Lupe,
or in other schools, etc.
Can you tell me if the land is public or private?
It's my family's house.
Okay.
Well, that's very
it's
generous.
Private,
it's
uh-huh.
wonderful.
Yeah, 2 acres is good.
And do you have any suggestions for Lupe about funding sort of revenue streams?
Is that something? Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I think that projects like this, one, besides being key to, you know, communities taking responsibility for their own welfare, if you can start with no resources, well, starting with the resource of land is the number one, of course, and it was great that you had that. I'm also a big advocate of using public land for these types of projects. But
yeah, you mentioned vacant lots.
Exactly. You know, but starting with limited resources actually, I think, helps the sustainability of the project in the long run, because getting funding can be a boost, but then relying on that funding can actually hinder the sustainability of the project in the long run, because right. funding comes and goes, and if you're dependent on that, when it goes, I've seen too many projects fold because they didn't get the grant the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'd really like to see is that people who believe in this just contribute to it without even being asked. We need angels that can just write checks to projects like this, rather than putting the onus on the projects to develop a whole administration to administrate grants and do all the soliciting of funding that's required. It's a couple full-time jobs to get grants, and it has nothing to do with gardening.
All right, well, calling on all angels who are listening, support community gardens. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and let's go to Jamie in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Call, Jamie.
Thanks. I love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
I'm a city person. I grew up in San Francisco, from City People. My mom's from New York, and we've always taken advantage of even the teeniest bit. You know, you literally sometimes can have a 2-foot by 2-foot like area of cement somewhere, but you know, you could maybe like, and generally in a case like that, it's more about creating some sort of teeny like nature space for you to take refuge in. But you know, like I've built little trellises and grown up the wall and maybe put a chair there and surrounded it with some herb plants that you can use. And so there are two things. One, I would really encourage people to take, it's amazing what you can do with the teeniest space. And then my other comment is that, and it relates to that, is the house that we live was recently sold. We're renters, and we had an area out back which we had transformed. It wasn't that big, but it was maybe like 15 feet by 5 feet, kind of a rectangular space. And we had transformed it into this awesome garden, growing a few things edible, just lots of plants, an incredible kind of nature refuge. And when the people bought it, they just kind of cemented everything over and stuck a great big barbecue out there, which is still nice. I guess they're making something. We had like a little eatsy beatsy barbecue, but they don't have any plants or any kind of naturey things. So, and I've seen that a lot with people where they have a space, but if it's a cement space, they feel it's just kind of the city cement space. And as a final thing, a few years ago for a friend, for a Valentine's present, I got some bricks and built these kind of like heart enclosures and got some soil and actually planted all these vegetables for him, and they did really well. So anyway, thank you so much.
Well, we appreciate your call. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us, Jamie. And I'm going to ask you both about advice for people who have small spaces after our break. We're talking with Pam Pierce. She's a master gardener and the author of Golden Gate Gardening, the complete guide to year-round food gardening in the San Francisco Bay Area and coastal California. And Daniel Miller is executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project, which is a nonprofit in Southwest Berkeley. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we want to take your calls about gardening. What's the significance of gardening in your life? If you have a garden, where is it, and what are you planting this spring? You can join our discussion by calling 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Does gardening change your feeling of connection to the natural world or to your community? And can local gardens help more people live healthier lives? Join us by calling 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
And you're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. And if you're on Facebook, becoming a fan of KALW is an easy way to spread the word about the programming that you value on local public radio. And it's easy. Just click the Facebook link on the front page of KALW.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll hear all about the upcoming San Francisco Film Festival. And on Friday, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about the week's news coverage. On Monday, with so many slated state park closures, what's the state park you'd save? Today, we're talking about the significance of gardening. We're sharing ideas about what it means to garden and what plants are best for planting and harvesting this time of year. From community gardens to guerrilla gardens to backyard and rooftop gardens, people are finding creative ways to grow plants for food, medicine, and beauty. So what are you planting this spring? And does gardening change the way you feel about the connection to your neighborhood or your community? You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-2255. Talk, that's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And if you have a show idea for us, you can send us a note at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also reach us through our new website where you can post comments. It's yourcallradio.org. And we're going to get to more calls in just a moment, 866-798-8255. If you don't have a garden, we'd also like to hear from you. Why not? What would make you take the leap to even just planting in your windowsill? 866-798-8255. And if you're a member of a community garden, we'd especially love to hear from you about how that's working and what are the challenges of getting one started. 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number. We're talking with Pam Pierce. She is the author of Golden Gate Gardening, and Daniel Miller. He's the executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project. And before we went to that break, Jamie was a caller and asked us, what's the advice you have for people who don't have very much space, who are living in small apartments, for example? So what's your advice for tiny spaces and gardening?
Container gardening is possible. People can grow food. Herbs are really good, lettuce, arugula, even tomatoes if you've got a deep enough pot. One of the things I did in Golden Gate Gardening was I told you how deep the pot should be for the different things that you're growing so that you don't waste depth of pot on something
how
that doesn't need it.
How deep should tomatoes be?
18 inches.
18 inches,
at least,
okay.
As big as you can handle.
And arugula doesn't need much at all, right?
No, lettuce doesn't need much. 6 or 8 would be okay, but there's a lot of range in between, and so you don't want to have something in too shallow or waste your space. If you have a little bit of room, as she was saying, on concrete, you can build raised beds. And again, don't build a bed that's higher than you need. So if you're growing things that have shallow roots, you could have a less deep bed. If you're building a very tall bed, a lot of people make the mistake of putting potting mix in a tall bed. If it's over 2 feet, you shouldn't be putting potting mix in it. You should be putting sandy loam in it, and then amending the top foot just as you would soil. It's cheaper, and it's better. It won't collapse on you and then have to be replaced in a couple of years. And it's also a good idea to trellis things when you have a chance to. And I've just finally gotten Cole Hardware on Mission Street in San Francisco to carry something called hog wire, which is 2x4-inch wire that you can turn on its side, 2x4-inch holes in the fencing. It's 4 feet tall, but you turn it on its side and you have a 4 foot wide trellis, and it's permanent. It stays for, 20, 30 years. It's much better than that nylon stuff. You put on a couple of stakes you stick in the ground or wire it out from a fence, and you've got something, place to grow beans and peas and things that need to climb. Cucumbers are good on a trellis, too.
Great. And Daniel, it looks like you have a little advice as well.
Absolutely. So first, it's so great to be on with Pam. I learned so much from her book early on. And
thank you, Daniel.
Sitting here with one of my mentors. But a couple more tips for container gardening for success is, one, you really got to check them every day. If they have sun on them, they can dry out more quickly than you think. So if you One of the ways that people kill their container gardens is just letting the pots go bone dry. And the other thing is to realize the plants have limited resources in the container. So usually just straight potting soil or sandy loam or whatever, just putting soil in often doesn't have enough fertilizer to start with. So fertilizing initially and partway along the way for the deeper feeding crops like tomatoes is really important for container gardening.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Let's go to Dorothy in Oakland. Welcome to your call, Dorothy.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to build on something that Pam said a little while ago. I have a garden in the Laurel District of Oakland, which is East Oakland. And it's very small but very sunny. And what I'm growing this year are a variety of veg and fruits. I have a fig tree and a nectarine tree, and broccoli, carrots, collards, strawberries, basil, green beans, artichokes. I'm just looking at my garden now. And so you can grow a variety of things in a really small space, because 4 years ago when I moved over here, I thought, oh, my God, it's so much smaller than my last place. I also have blueberries.
Blueberries?
Yeah.
I didn't know you could grow blueberries.
Fruit, but they're really cute. So I have hope for them. What I wanted to say is, you know, I grew up in one of those food deserts that your guest talked about earlier in West Oakland. But in East Oakland, when I was about 12, my grandmother's older sister taught me about gardening.
Hmm.
And she had an equally tiny space. And her sun porch, which I now also have, was just filled with all these clippings that she had gotten from people. We'd go on walks, and she'd snip things out of people's yards, you know, if it was hanging over a fence. And she taught me how, you know, from apparently nothing, you could grow food, you know, when you finish your, you know, Halloween pumpkin, save those seeds, you know. And I'm still doing that, too, you know, just saving seeds with, you know, if I go to the farmer's market, I save my green bean seeds sometimes and things like that.
And but, do you think we're losing some of that art? Is it being passed down from generation to generation?
I don't think it is. I don't think it is, because I still meet kids now who don't even know where food comes from. Like, what animal did a chicken McNugget come from? The connection's not even made.
That's
frightening.
And so it's really frightening. And I think, you know, in my generation, I was born in the 50s, we had people who had just come from the South,
mm-hmm.
who had come from agrarian societies, you know, and communities. And so it wasn't lost on people in my generation to grow your own food, have at least some collards in your, you know, my family's from Arkansas. At least have a little bit of something. It doesn't have to be everything. You know, nobody was expecting us in Oakland to butcher hogs or anything, but have a little something, a little few veg or a fruit tree or something in your yard.
Well, Dorothy, stay with us, because I'm going to put that to Pam and Daniel. I mean, I know that there's this big movement for school gardens and for teaching about cooking and growing food, but are we losing some of this historical memory of farming and growing our own food and the source of food?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole impetus for why Spiral Gardens exists. If that wasn't happening, I would be doing something else if we were in a community where that information was still intact. Now, we haven't lost it. And, you know, it's the best and worst of times, actually, right now, because we're losing that information rapidly. At the same time, a lot of people are finding it and passing it on. And sharing of information is so key right now, because there are elders who still have the information. It's still out there. We haven't lost it yet. We just have to really treasure it and pass it on. We all need to learn, and then each one teach one as much as possible.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so inspiring to hear of all of these, you know, these new community gardens that are popping up. Pam?
I think in some cases we lose a generation of knowledge because there has been such privation and work associated with farming that the next generation doesn't want to have anything to do with it, and that a generation or two later people are interested in it again. And I also think that there's something about being an adolescent that is the opposite of being a gardener. Not always, but it's a very strong tendency to not be interested in gardening when you're a teenager. And I think that it comes back as you get older. And so it's an interesting thing. I think kids have to be introduced to it when they're young, and then they're going to have other interests for a few years, and then they come back to having that interest. And if someone would like to read a book that gives you some of the, it's a really good feel-good book. There's one called Parsnips in the Snow, and it is short pieces, interviews with gardeners and farmers who made it work for them and their families. And it's everything from someone who just does a personal garden to someone who gardens and shares with the whole neighborhood to someone who has a farm and the whole extended family comes once a year and preserves food and takes it home with them. And these are from mid-20th century. And it's just a very wonderful collection of essays. And
well, thank you for
recommend
that.
To anyone.
Parsnips in the Snow. And we are blessed with a very nice, mild climate here in California
right. That
makes gardening much easier than in the snow. Thank you so much for calling, Dorothy. It was great to hear your story. Let's hear from Helen in Watsonville. Welcome to your call, Helen.
Hi there.
Hi.
I enjoy the discussion very much. I'm an avid gardener myself and have started a garden at my daughter's school. I think it's really great. And I think the most important thing to be thinking about here is we have to be very careful where these gardens are placed. Here in Watsonville, there's a big push to put these gardens on the wetlands.
On the wetlands,
right next to the wetlands. Because in some people's mind, wetlands area is just barren, unused land. So they come by and they look at it and they go, oh, God, I would love to garden right next to this water. Isn't it pretty? But it's an environmentally sensitive area. So I will caution all of you people who have a zeal and apparently a real passion for this. Look at where you're putting these gardens. See if they're appropriate for that area. See if there's an ecologically fragile area. Here in Watsonville, there's been such a push put the farming back on the wetlands, and these gardens are farms. There's irrigation, there's tilling of the land. It's nice and it's pretty, but it is a farm.
Yes, I think in urban areas it's best if you could put a community garden on in a fill-in area.
What does that mean, a fill-in area?
It means an area that's surrounded already by urban.
Exactly.
Rather than an area at the edge of a wild area. I think it would be preferable to have it surrounded by urban areas.
And Daniel wanted to say something about that as well.
Absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely no reason to use whatever remaining pristine ecosystems there may be, even if they're not pristine, there's no reason to take wildland anymore and use it for gardens. There's enough land that can be reclaimed. And one of the reasons there may seem like there's not enough room is because we've built housing on our best farming land. Most cities exist because they were the most fertile places and people congregated to them because they were the best places to grow food. And now there's this myth of rural versus urban. What I'm saying is a real justification to grow food in the city. There's nothing strange about it. It's some of the best soil you can get as long as it's not toxic. We've talked a little bit about how to check that. And there's also vast tracts of corporate agriculture that eventually, if our petroleum becomes too expensive, something's going to need to be done with that land. And I'm looking forward when that can be divided into 10-acre parcels for all of us.
That's Daniel Miller. He's executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project. We're also joined by Pam Pierce, who's author of Golden Gate Gardening and Wildly Successful Plants, Northern California. And we're talking about gardening, food justice, and creating community. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. You can join our conversation by calling 1-866-798-8255. I've got some emails to read here in just a second, but you can call us and join the conversation 1-866-798-8255. If you've started a community garden, we'd love to hear about your experience and find out where you've done it and what were the obstacles. 1-866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number. And let's go to Anna in Watsonville. Hi, Anna.
Hi. Hi.
Welcome.
How coincidental. Thank you. How coincidental to come after another caller from Watsonville. There aren't that many.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of community gardening going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of things happening there. And I started a nonprofit food justice program about 2 years ago called Mesa Verde Gardens. And we, among other things, are doing community gardening in Watsonville with low-income families. our projects are infill. We're leasing land from churches that have really big lots that have just been a fallow land for up to 30 years, some of them. And
what a great idea.
Yeah. So last year we had 30 families on one garden, and it was really successful. This year we have 80 families on three gardens. And it's really fun. It's all for families, and it's grant-funded for to make an impact on the childhood obesity and diabetes epidemic. And most of the people we work with are participating are actually farm workers and have lots and lots of skills on how to grow food. They just don't have a place to do it.
Well, you know, that was a question that I wanted to bring up. Stay with us, Anna, and let me ask all
sure.
of you. I mean, there is this irony, terrible irony, that a lot of people who are picking and harvesting the food in, you know, in California's agricultural lands are food insecure themselves.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are. Yeah, it is beyond ironic. But most of them will have a background, even as children, as having growing a lot of food in their home, pueblos and different things, and they were happy to have their children actually make the connection between a seed and a plant and good food. And our gardens are all pesticide-free, so they're getting to have organic food at, you know, basically free.
One of the insights of sustainable farmers is that if you pay the farm workers very little, then the entire community suffers, and the entire community is not sustainable.
Yeah.
And it's a pity of our economic system that it's dependent upon, well, I'm not sure that it is, but seems to think it's dependent upon paying farm workers so little. Trader Joe's apparently just made a contract with some growers in Florida to raise the price of the
tomatoes
to the picker 1 penny, and it's just
and
made
that
a great
was a
deal
big
of,
fight
made,
to
made,
do
but
that.
It's made a great deal of difference, and I think
that was the coalition of Immokalee workers.
This can be a huge
if
help.
I could make a little plug, we're going to have a radio program on your sister station in Pacific Grove, KAZU, tomorrow morning at 6:06, 7:06, and 8:06. There's a feature story about Mesa Verde Gardens.
Well, thanks so much, and we're going to put a link to Mesa Verde. Thanks very much. We're going to put a link to Mesa Verde at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. Let me read a related email from Charlie. He says, could you talk about the politics involved in setting up a community garden on spaces like abandoned parking lots? What agencies would a community need to contact to get the okay to build a community farm in their area? And what are the bureaucratic hurdles? Do you want to take that, Daniel?
Sure. And just briefly on the other issue, quickly, is it's not only ironic that farm workers get paid so little. It's actually, I think, it's intentional. It's one of the ways we have artificially cheap food, and that's the thing about buying organic food that costs more is you're actually paying somebody's wage as well. And I think that's really important. Farm workers are not only food insecure, but they're kept insecure in many other ways. So as far as taking over lots, the first thing is to research who owns that lot if you identify one in your neighborhood. And the best place to do that is at the county tax office, the assessor's office. It's public records, who owns lots, and you can find out the owner of record and try to contact them. I have been dissuaded from using private lots from my history with it. Generally, even if you get permission to use it, the owner is going to change their mind at some point, or economic necessity is going to force them to sell it, or they may pass away at some point and someone in their family will inherit it. I would really encourage folks to look at public land at this point. I think municipalities are becoming more aware of the benefits of letting people actually grow food on public land. It takes a lot of community organizing to do that, and there's a whole community process around getting a use permit to use public land for that. But I found that we did that for Spiral Gardens. We're on two blocks of public land, a former railroad right-of-way that was vacant for 30 years.
And what permissions did you have to get from the city? Was it hard?
It was a long process. We had to go through the city council in the beginning and the end. We had to go through the Parks Commission. We had to go through the Planning Commission. We got a use permit, administrative use permit, and a license agreement to use it. But what we did first, and I think this is really important, was we went to the whole neighborhood first. We made an initial plan and a survey, and we went door to door and talked with about 1,200 doors in the neighborhood. just to get everybody on board first to see what the problems were going to be, what issues people would have with it, so we could anticipate what those issues would be, and we could address them before anything ever went to City Council. And that process was really good because it just put us, it was the homework that groups should really do anyway, to really get in touch with your community and what the needs of the community are.
And that's a real community building exercise.
Exactly.
I have another email from Chuck. I have a great yard and very little time to garden properly. I've done a little bit a couple of years ago, but I'm a single dad of teens. Is there a resource to match those with the desire and no space, and those of us with space and no time? Is there a resource that exists of that sort? Gosh, that would be, that's a
where,
website somebody needs to
where
do.
Where is he? Where does
Garden
he live?
Match. I don't know. This is an email. Chuck, if you want to call us back and let us know where you live, but there's no such a sort of a Craigslist for gardens and gardeners?
No, that's a perennial idea that keeps coming up. But the thing is, it would take someone to coordinate it, and that's the hard part. It's started up like the Berkeley Community Garden Collaborative, Bebo, who coordinates that, Bebo Terman, did make some forays in the starting that. There's a fellow named Lawrence in our community that's trying to do that.
Lawrence in Berkeley?
Yeah,
we
Lawrence in Berkeley. He may call in. But it's one of those institutions that needs to happen, just like neighborhood gleaning programs people talk about all the time, like harvesting, mapping fruit trees and harvesting in the neighborhood, make sure that doesn't get wasted. These are ideas that have been around for a long time.
I think
so
depending,
somebody just needs to
make it happen. Yeah, Pam?
I think that there isn't. You're right. But I think that depending on where you live, you might find some community organizations, such as in San Francisco, the Garden for the Environment, or in Berkeley, I mean, Oakland, Spiral Gardens or City Slicker Farms, who would know someone who would garden responsibly in your garden, because that's really what you want. You don't want someone to garden in your garden. You want someone to garden responsibly in your garden.
So Chuck, call a community gardening organization and ask if there's somebody that they want to send over that they trust. That seems like a good way to do it. Let's go to Karen in Sokol. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Yes, I live in Sokol, the mountains above Santa Cruz. And the ecosystem up here is just absolutely perfect. I'm above the fog line. It's very warm. I want to put a plug in for the Homeless Garden Project in Santa Cruz. Over, I don't know, 300 people. And that's where I got initially really energized by doing a garden again. I live on 5 acres. I rent. And the owners of this property up here don't want a garden because of they're afraid that it's going to attract animals. So I spoke with other neighbors. And we have a community garden going at somebody else's house. So the guy, you know, gave us his backyard, and it is fabulous. I'm so excited about it, and it brings all the neighbors together. Quality of life has just shot up for me, and I think as for the neighbors as well.
That's just great. That's so wonderful to hear your story. Thanks so much, Karen.
You're welcome.
And let's also go to Kate. Kate in Aptos. Welcome to your call.
Hello, my name is Kate, and thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that I just finished reading a book with my book club. It's called Animal Vegetable Miracle. Mm-hmm. And it really brought
Barbara Kingsolver, right?
How much it costs for a product to get from where it originally is grown or picked up to the grocery store, wherever its final destination is. It's about 1,500 miles, according to this. And the issue there is how much oil we're using in transportation for our food. So my thought is that, and my goal is to go to the local farmers market as often as possible, and to buy organic as often as possible.
Well, thank you so much, Kate. We're running out of time, and I want to get some final thoughts from our guests. Let me just read one more email from Claire Splann, who's the author of California Fruit and Vegetable Gardening. She says, I just wanted to add to the recent trends in small space gardening, container gardening, and vertical gardening are bringing people to gardening who previously would have felt gardening was not an option for them. People with little or no real gardening space are learning to garden on balconies, fire escapes, or very small spaces. And thank you for that, Claire. And so we just have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to get your final thoughts on what you said, Daniel, about planting seeds of a new culture. What's giving you reason for inspiration? What should people know and be thinking about? Go ahead and start, and then we'll go to Pam.
Well, that's part of our name, Spiral Gardens, is for this information to be spiraling out. I think that existing examples are very important. So as long as there's projects like these or people doing it in their front yards or sharing it with their neighborhood so that people can see it, to think about it, and that is what's going to, you know, recreate the culture that we're talking about. I also just like to put a plug in real quick. We're having a fundraiser on April 27th. It's going to be at a space called Cloud 9 at 1320 9th Street in Berkeley.
Okay, we'll put that information at our website. And Lupe from Comstock Community Farm also is looking for volunteers for an event on April 28th. We'll put a link to that at our website as well. Go ahead, Pam. Final thoughts on what people should be thinking about planting these seeds of a new culture.
Well, I think that there is a wonderful joy in growing your own food, and that it isn't related to having a farm and rows or even a large garden. It isn't related to having rows and rows of something that you then can or freeze or dry or do something with to get through the winter. In fact, in California, we don't have to do that to get through the winter, and that that every piece of food that you bring into your house and put into your kitchen and put into your garden is going to connect you to the history of human culture and is going to be a joy and a pleasure. And so we need to think not in terms of quantity, but in terms of quality and in terms of trying to get it to be year-round. You can plant in Golden Gate Gardening. There's a simple planting chart that starts with four seasons, and you just divide your garden into four spaces, and plant something in each of those seasons, and pretty soon you've got something happening in your kitchen every month of the year, and it's so much fun.
And as we've heard from so many people, it's also a way to know your neighbors and to create community as well as eat healthily.
Right, when you garden together, it certainly is.
So that's Pam Pierce. She is the author of Golden Gate Gardening, The Complete Guide to Year-Round Food Gardening in the San Francisco Bay Area and Coastal California. She's also the author of Wildly Successful Plants, Northern California. We've also been joined by Daniel Miller. He's executive director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project. That's a nonprofit in Southwest Berkeley. We'll put a link to all of that information, plus the information that you heard on our show today, at our website, yourcallradio.org. You can also post comments there and tell us what you're doing. Thanks for joining us. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. The role of FBI informants changed since the enactment of the Patriot Act. On the next Your Call, we'll mark the beginning of the 55th annual San Francisco International Film Festival by discussing one of its featured films, Informant. The film follows the story of an activist turned FBI informant. How has the FBI changed since the Patriot Act? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What do activists need to know about their rights? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.